From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Balen Saleh, broadcaster in VOA's Kurdish service. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Kanan Makia, the well-known Iraqi-American intellectual who made the case for the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2002. A professor of Islamic and Middle Eastern studies at Brandeis University in Massachusetts, Makia is best known for his best-selling book, The Republic of Fear, which exposed Saddam Hussein's reign of terror just before his 1990 invasion of Kuwait. His new book, The Rope, is a work of fiction, but which evokes many truths, including the murder of the son of Iraq's most influential cleric of the 20th century, Abul Qasim al-Huwi. The novel is an indictment of the early years after the U.S.-led invasion, not so much of the Americans, but of his own people, the long-repressed Shiite majority. Makia says he is still grateful to the United States for removing Saddam, which he sees as morally correct, but is critical of the way that the invasion and post-war occupation was conducted and of today's chaos. The book stands as a, quote, apology of sorts, not for advocating the removal of Saddam, but for bestowing legitimacy on a group of men who, he says, have proved incapable of ruling Iraq. And Kanan Makia joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Professor Makia, welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me, Carolyn. Thank you for that kind introduction.
And I'm always delighted to welcome my colleague from the Kurdish service, Balen Saleh.
Thank you, Carol.
Well, Professor Makia, it's truly an honor to have you here to talk about your new book, The Rope, and all that it conveys. First, talk about the title. It implies the hanging of Saddam Hussein. Discuss the symbolism of the title and its meaning in Arabic.
The rope is the rope that quite literally was used to hang Saddam Hussein on December 30th, 2006. So it appears in one of the early chapters in the first part of the book, where an absolutely disgraceful scene takes place. Incidentally, this is historical fiction, but every piece of it rests on truth. So there is evidence, and I researched this for years. The rope was, bits of it were cut and sold, and a competition developed over this artifact. That disgraceful scene that took place immediately after the hanging features my narrator, who is a Shiite militiaman in the Mahdi army, appointed to be there on the day of the hanging. He, of course, is a fictional character, but he is the voice, the narrator's voice throughout the text. He actually participates in this cutting up of the rope and the selling of this artifact as though it were a relic of some claim. And then he is revolted at himself. That revolt, that sense of disgust at his own behavior, he knew, he sensed right away his mother and father, both of whom were dead, would never have approved of that kind of behavior. And throughout the book, he is engaged in a quest, a journey for, let's call it, the truth behind not the death of all Iraqis, but the truth behind the death of one man whose body, as a young boy, you know, in his early 20s, he stumbled upon on the day that the tyrant fell, April 10th, 2003. That body, he doesn't know at the time who it is, and he spends the bulk of the book searching for the true story behind the murder and the assassination of this man. Well, at the end of the book, he learns all kinds of terrible things. He learns the identity of the dead man. The dead man is the son of the Grand Ayatollah Abul Qasim al-Huwi, whom you mentioned, Majid al-Huwi. The son had returned from opposition. He had fled Iraq during the 1991 uprising. He had been part of the Iraqi opposition abroad, working from London. And he returned a good 2-3 weeks before the actual fall to convince the clerical establishment, of which he was a part, that in fact this war is something they should support at the time. His murder by the son of another Grand Ayatollah turns out to be the head of his very own militia, namely a man we know as very active in Iraqi politics today, Muqtada al-Sadr, issued the order for the murder. So you have this remarkable symbolic event. The son of one Grand Ayatollah, who worked with the opposition to Saddam, is murdered by the son of another Grand Ayatollah who never left Iraq and who stayed inside and who, of course, opposed the occupation, but whose own father and two brothers were murdered by Saddam. Both of these sons, the one who murdered the other, have lost near and dear ones to the tyrant himself. But this murder, on the very day that the tyrant falls, more importantly even, the cover-up of that murder, becomes a symbol of the way in which I develop my critique, using the form of the novel, of the ruling elite, especially the Shia elite, as you pointed out, that was responsible for that cover-up. The cover-up means that the very rule of law, the justice that the Shia sought, rightly so, just like the Kurds seek justice, that, it turns out, it is sad. This was a very difficult book to write. It is sad but true that those who seek justice could not be just themselves. That is really the point of the book. Of course, the injustice is bigger than just the cover-up. What I'm talking about is the birth of a language of sectarianism in Iraq. There always were, of course, sectarianism is present in society, the way racism is present in American society. But if the driving force of the new elite inside the governing council plays a role in its inculcation, then it is turned from something that is in society that would take, you know, as we all know, generations and generations to attempt to reverse. It turns into a poison that infects the body politic as a whole.
And I suppose as someone who was in favor of the fall of Saddam and the U.S.-led invasion, which led to that, you were extremely disappointed, and that comes out very clearly in your book. But why are you so hard on yourself and hard on the Shia who had been so oppressed under Saddam? Why are you so hard on the Iraqis and the Shia in particular and not hard on the Americans who, you know, led the invasion itself?
There are very, very many good books about all the things that the United States did wrong in Iraq post-2003. I didn't want to tell that story again. I wanted to tell a truly Iraqi story. That is, the Americans and Arabs know everything that the Americans did wrong. There are very many things we could list them right now. I, of course, also think they were wrong. But this is a book about the greater wrong. For if there were failings in this 2003 experiment that started in Iraq, to be sure there are American failings, but in my opinion, by far the bigger failing was an Iraqi one than it was an American one. The United States would have fallen over itself and tried to correct its errors, but unfortunately, it was those who stood to lose the most who committed the most grievous errors, and that is, of course, Iraqis. And Shia Iraqis in particular suffered greatly. Hundreds of thousands of them were killed in the revenge attacks of Saddam after the 1991 Gulf War. They had not really ruled themselves since their inception. That is over 1,000 years ago. So they had a lot to seek justice for. But by losing Iraq, which is what's happening today, they were losing their own great chances to not only get justice, but to enormously improve their conditions. Think of this remarkable fact. The United States knew it was empowering a community that had not exercised power and that was victimized. That is why 13, notice the number, out of 25, i.e. a slight majority of the total number of people who were appointed as a governing council, think of it as a nucleus of the future elite of Iraq, many of whom still rule us today and who are former exiles who have basically ruled, essentially, effectively taken the prime positions in every single major government since 2003 onwards. They were theoretically acting in the name of their community. For the sake of their own community, wisdom suggests that they needed to reach out to everybody else and build a consensus and a different kind of state than one that started with settling accounts.
I have to ask you a very quick follow-up. So do you think it was naive to think that the oppressed, that is the Shia majority, put in this unique position to lead, could have done better? What are the factors, in your view, that led them not to be able to do better, even though they were defending the idea of Iraq and a more inclusive Iraq long before they came into power?
Well, I could talk about sociology and I could talk about ethnography and various things like that. I could talk about victims and how difficult it is for victims to shed their victimhood. We all know there is a pattern in history, in human psychology. Abused children turn into abusers. The relationship between being a victim and being able to overcome that is a very, very complex one. But that's sociology, that's psychology, that's a whole other. In the world of politics, coming out of an experience such as that of Iraq's 33 years of exceptionally nasty tyranny, a tyranny that even by the terrible standards of the neighborhood is the worst of the lot, namely Saddam Hussein, a tyranny that had waged war after war, that had waged genocide against the Kurdish people, that had pulled the whole region into turmoil, that had actually invaded, annexed, and raped a neighboring state, Kuwait, in 1990. This is exceptional, even by the standards of our part of the world. Now, the be-all and end-all of my politics always was, nothing is more important than removing this kind of cancer from the body politic of Iraq. And for that, I don't have any regret. But it was never going to be easy to transition to something else.
Certainly.
I remember Bill Moyer in the program called Now. On the eve of the war, he told me, okay, Mr. McKeer, I want you to give me a percentage chance of success. You say you want democracy. I said, yes, I struggle for democracy. I argue for it. I believe in it. And I want it to happen. And it is possible. Okay, how possible? He wanted to know. Give me a percentage. I always try to avoid that question because I trap myself when other journalists have asked it. But this was Bill Moyer, and the great British historian Simon Sharma was on the program. And with people like that, it is hard to avoid answering questions sometimes. But I gave him an answer that I still stand by today. I said, Mr. Moyers, even if there was only a 5% chance of success, it is my moral obligation as an Iraqi to fight for that 5%. It's still 5%. And that 5% depends on, not obviously, not me personally, but depends on us who are in the privileged position now of trying to change this country. And I stand by that. What percentage is it really? Five? More? Doesn't matter. It's an obligation to pursue it. How else can you take a country as abused as Iraq and expect it to turn if you think it has anything more than five? I mean, I think of Iraq as a giant concentration camp. Somebody from outer space came, knocked down the walls. They had their own reasons. They did it badly. But it's now the inmates inside and the ones who came flying in from outside. After all, the government and all those 25 members were people in exile, like myself, coming from countries like Iran, like London, like the United States, and so on. It's their obligation to try to make a success story. But it's not easy. It was never going to be easy. My worst fears, you could say, were realized. And the reason I wrote this book, you said I was sad. I was not sad. I went into a semi-depression. I mean, I pulled out of it by the writing of this book. By the way, I'm not writing this book to settle accounts with former friends. I'm not writing this book to say, you know, I told you so or anything like that. I wrote this book because I am, even though it is a novel, a seeker for the truth of what went wrong. And the truth of that betrayal of that 5% chance. And that is why I felt I had to write it.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Kanan Makia, an Iraqi-American professor of Islamic and Middle Eastern Studies at Brandeis University and author of the best-selling Republic of Fear. We're discussing his new book, The Rope. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Malin Saleh. He's broadcaster in VOA's Kurdish service. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout-out to Abraham Villegas from Philippines. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And now let me turn to my colleague, Balin Saleh.
Thank you, Carol. Mr. Makia, my question will be regarding the democracy in Iraq. Why we should expect that the democracy will be an easy task for the Iraqis, and especially when Iraq as a country is surrounded by a variety of countries like Turkey, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Syria, and even Jordan. What the Iraqis can do?
I don't think it was an easy task. As I said, it had a 5% chance of success. And I agree with you. Iraq is a country at the time of 2003 especially, and until today, sitting in a ring of fire of enemies all around, doing everything they possibly can, especially in 2003, to make this experiment, which is what it was, unsuccessful and not lead to a democratic result. Remember, democracy threatens them all. So it is perfectly understandable why they are targeting this experiment. What I do think, though, is we don't make their job easier for them. And what I fear we did, especially the members of the governing council or the elite of Iraq, and as I said, the Shia elite in particular, made that task much easier by playing the sectarian card. Let me say a word here. In my book, Cruelty and Silence, which you probably know, it has been translated into Kurdish also, I had a chapter on the future of Iraq. This is 1993 we're talking about. So we're a long way away. We're a decade away from the war. In that, I said, the future of Iraq will hang on the behavior of the new leadership in the early months, even couple of years, that very crucial framework at the moment of transition itself. And especially it will hang on the Shia, because they form a natural majority of the population. How they handle themselves is crucial. You cannot expect the Kurds, with their autonomous experiment, with their own experiences and their own victimhood at the hands of Arabs and Iraqis in the past and of all the surrounding states, to lead that experiment. You cannot expect Sunni Iraqis, which is also a minority, relatively 20-25, maybe 30%, I don't know exactly, of the population, to lead it either, because they are quite naturally going to be fearful, defensive, prickly, worried, full of foreboding for the future. But the Shia, who had so much to gain, I'm not talking about the Shia people, I'm talking about the nucleus of the future elite that was going to construct the language of politics that was going to predominate. They had a larger than their proportion share of responsibility for making this a success. There are very, very few Nelson Mandelas in this world of ours, right? But think of Nelson Mandela's experience. An overwhelmingly black population suffered a explicit regime of racism called apartheid. So how does Nelson Mandela approach, theoretically, how does he handle the question of the transition from a white apartheid racist state to a black majority rule? He attended an all-white game of football, which only the white Afrikaner population used to play. He donned a sweatshirt of the white Afrikaners. He put this thing on and he went and he won over the hearts and minds of the whites, who were crucial to the economy, to the success of the new South Africa, stayed and helped participate and build that state. Does that mean they don't have problems? Of course they have problems. Would we have had problems? Of course we would have had problems. All kinds of problems. But notice the spirit. So what I say, judged by those standards, the failure is historic. But we needed something like those standards to make this extraordinary experiment, this 95% chance of going wrong, to make it work. And we didn't have it.
You needed someone in the Shia community to put themselves in the shoe of the other,
exactly,
as
right.
Mandela did. So that leads us to some extent, you know, where do we go from here and what lessons can we learn? Because we're seeing the same pattern, unfortunately. And we're seeing, you know, the rise of ISIS. Where are we going? Because it seems like a vicious circle now.
Terry,
if I may, in addition to what Carol said, I feel there is a gap right now from 2003 until now, 2016, between the Shia population and the Shia leadership in Iraq. I do receive a lot of emails, Facebook or FaceTimes from my friends in Basra, in Amara, in Nasiriyah. They are telling me that everything went wrong with this leadership. We need a real Iraqi leadership to put everything back on track.
Yes, Baran, I agree with you. I mean, my critique, and this is the sad thing which I think you are pointing to, I mean, think of the 2010 elections. By and large, the meaning of those elections was that very, very large number of Iraqis were saying, we don't want sectarian politics, by the votes that they gave to the Alawi list. But it was the leaders whose social positions were buttressed by sectarian politics who injected it back again. And unfortunately, at that time, the United States backed the wrong Maliki. And sectarian politics, when it comes from the top down, is deadly. It's like a cancer. It enters and spreads through the whole body politic. But notice some of the odd thing. Sectarian, you'd think, by definition of that, is somebody who puts his community before all others, who wants to abandon the idea of Iraq or anybody else's rights other than his community, who sees politics as a zero-sum game in which everything is about seeking advantage for yourself. How much of the pie can you take? And you'll squeeze the other person down, who is not thinking of anything other than that, sets in motion a deadly logic. You'd think that the community would be at least united. It's not. The divisions within the Shia community, politically speaking, I mean, are phenomenal. I mean, I count in my novel 267 armed groups in the year 2006 operating inside Iraq. Most of them, many of them, Shia and Sunni. A complete, let us call it, fragmentation. It is as though power has now, because of sectarianism, shattered as though it were a sheet of glass that fell on a concrete floor. It broke into hundreds of divisions, and those divisions are not going to go away soon. Think of now we're facing Mosul. Certified certainty that ISIS will be defeated in Mosul. There's simply no question. But the question is, who will emerge symbolically the winner of that? The Iraqi state, the Iraqi army, or the Hashd al-Sha'bi, the so-called popular militia that has come into being, that is largely run by Iran? Iranian influence inside Iraq today is something that has gone beyond anything in modern history. And it is also, like any kind of influence of that nature, very hard to untangle and take apart. So there will be a fight even after the success story of the defeat of ISIS. And ISIS is no longer the problem, believe me. I know everybody in Iraq is told and made to think, though, ISIS is the problem, and therefore everything else is subordinate. I can level the houses of Sunnis in this, that, and the other town because ISIS is out there. ISIS today is just a flag that people wave to do injustice to their own population.
I agree with you, but there is another concern that after ISIS in Mosul, there will be a huge fight between the Sunni tribes, the one they supported Daesh and the one they were against Daesh. Another question is, I told you that there's a gap between the Shia population and Shia leadership, but since 2003 until now, we are seeing those faces in power. Why the Iraqi people, the Iraqi Shia, voting for them?
Well, I mentioned the last elections, the 2010 elections, and how those turned out. There they tried and failed. Because this is a country, remember, Iraq, post-2003, which is learning to do politics for the first time in its life. I mean, remember, there was no politics under Saddam. Now, 30 years is a very long time to not have politics. You don't have leaders naturally emerging from that sector of the population, fighting battles, local battles, first of all, community battles, then afterwards bigger battles, entering parliament. You don't have that. As a result, politics is a game that nobody knows the rules of. Its rules are being made. That would be my first answer. Then the people who set the rules all flew in from outside. Now that's, in a sense, no alternative to it. Because there are no politics inside Iraq, I mean, if you want a leadership to guide this country, they come from outside. There's historically always been problems with exiles like myself trying to rule a country that they have been away from for anything from 10 to 20 to even more number of years. So we're going through that. It's not the fault of the Shia population. It is the fault of the leadership that chose to play the game of politics as though there was no other game in town. Not one of them spoke in the name of something bigger than their community, in the name of something called Iraq. Take this thing called Iraq. I know it's supposedly artificial, and so on, but what state is not artificial if you think about it? Look at the whole of Latin America, Africa, Southeast Asia. Not every state that's artificial remains permanently artificial.
And of all countries, Iraq really was such an entity.
Of course.
I mean, I know the Jewish community, they're first Iraqi. Then the religious identity.
That's very true. But there is no politician speaking in the name of something called Iraq. However it is organized, let that happen inside. It'll be different. But an entity, a thing that you can put your heart in it, that you can say, I feel for this thing. If that's not coming from the entire class of politicians, on the contrary, something else is coming.
Yeah, and this is one of the main problems because the Iraqi leaders, the Iraqi politicians, they cannot unify their definition for new Iraq.
But as we close, Kanan Makia, you did reference the role of Iran, and you're trying to underplay to some extent the role of external actors like Iran in the United States, but they have an influence on these people inside. So I'd like you to address as we close, you know, what lessons can we learn about what happened in Iraq and how we can apply that to the aftermath of the Arab Spring? You know, some people like to see what happened in Iraq and say, oh, look what happened to Iraq, and therefore we shouldn't get involved in the aftermath of other countries, whether Egypt or right now Syria. Syria. Look what happened if we do something in Syria. Didn't we learn something in Iraq? We shouldn't do it. How do we calibrate when to intervene? And I'm not referring to troops on the ground, but helping those inside who say they want a certain amount of assistance, both politically and militarily.
Let me first say that we are now in a very different world than we were in 2003. Notice, Syria was never invaded by the United States. It was not occupied by the United States. And yet the state collapsed today, and we have a civil war of truly historic dimensions occurring, with 11 million displaced, 500,000 now killed, and the refugees pushing in their millions on the borders of Europe, creating an international situation we haven't seen since World War II. So my point is this: the Iraq problem, which is how we saw it, is very singularly focused on Iraq in 2002 and the run-up to the 2003 war, is now a problem of the Middle Eastern nation state, from Iran right the way across through Northern Africa. So it's a big one. There are no easy solutions. We may be in what you might call something like the dark ages of this world, for there is no easy solutions to Syria. And the Iraq problem today is not just an Iraq problem. It's hostage to the Syria problem. It's hostage to what happens in Kurdistan. It is part of this bigger dark period that we are going through. Part of that dark period is the involvement of everybody and his uncle in the affairs of this part of the world, especially Iran, but also Russia now. And of course, the United States is pulling back and pulling back at this very moment. So we are in a really new situation. The major Arab countries that might have played a role, why should we say, what should the United States do? Why isn't Egypt doing anything? What about Saudi Arabia? Why isn't there an Arab army of 300,000 people, you know, along with Jordan, boarding up there to deal with ISIS, to solve the nation-state problem in Syria? Why are 500,000 people allowed to die, and the whole rest of the Arab world sit down there, wringing their hands and watching and asking America to do something for it? This is a deep problem of the structure of the state in this part of the world. So there are not going to be easy solutions. It is no longer even in Syrian hands what happens in Syria. It's in a whole lot of other interested parties' hands. Think of the religious wars in the 16th and 17th century in Europe, and that is your model for what's going on.
And just quickly as we close, a well-known analyst here in the United States of Lebanese descent, Hisham Melham, says that President Obama overlearned Iraq. He wanted to do, in fact, the opposite of what George W. Bush did by going in, taking down Saddam, and then not managing the aftermath properly, notwithstanding the role of Iraqis, as you say. But what he's saying is inaction is also not a good thing. To some extent, the United States, the so-called friends of Syria, may have helped to create the very situation we're seeing in Syria now by their very inaction. So again, what do we conclude? That the strong man, Saddam or Bashar al-Assad, is that the only way to go? That liberal representative democracy may not be able to flourish in the Arab world? Or is Tunisia perhaps a tenuous exception and a light for the future?
Even that nostalgic image, which is today traveling the circles inside Iraq and outside it, of another Saddam coming up, is out of the question. Remember that sheet of glass analogy. Iraq is a sheet of glass that has shattered into 1,000 pieces. There is no Saddam out there that can pull the 1,000 pieces together. What we do have is 100 little Saddams running around doing the same on a different scale. That's the proper analogy. So what I would say is this: they are not any longer internal solutions. We need a conference of nations, which involves all the big players. We need the Arab world to step in and put their money where their mouth is, namely put their boots on the ground to pull together the remaining state. We know that Bashar al-Assad cannot pull together Syria. We know Syrians have paid a huge price, and anybody who is responsible for the death of that, for by far the orders of magnitude greater the number of Syrians who died at the hands of Bashar al-Assad and his regime than ever died at the hands of ISIS. ISIS is a disease that has to be uprooted, of course.
And to some extent a byproduct of the likes of a Bashar al-Assad
exactly.
Or a Saddam Hussein.
Exactly.
The book is The Rope. The author, Kanan Makia, he's professor of Islamic and Middle Eastern Studies at Brandeis University, and he's also the author of the previously best-selling book, Republic of Fear. Kanan Makia, thank you so much for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you for inviting me, Carol and Balan.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Al Santos, and joining me on the program was Balen Saleh, broadcaster for VOA's Kurdish service. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.